For decades, when Israel found itself at the center of the world's toughest question, there was one man who often stepped in front of the cameras, explaining his country's actions to presidents, prime ministers, journalists, and millions watching around the world. South Africa often asks the questions, why is Israel doing what it is doing? Mark Regev has spent a lifetime asking the opposite question. Why doesn't the world understand what Israel is doing? Those two are not the same question. He has served in Washington, Beijing, London, the Foreign Ministry as the Prime Minister's international spokesperson for nearly a decade, twice as senior advisor to the Prime Minister, and returned after October 7th specifically to become Israel's principal international voice during the country's biggest security crisis. Today, he joins us not simply to talk about Middle East politics, but about diplomacy, power, narrative, and whether in a world where perception increasingly shapes reality, Israel is winning battles while losing something far bigger. Mark, you know, Israel militarily remains strong. Economically, it is resilient. Intelligence-wise, it's still one of the most innovative countries with the highest number of Nobel laureates. And yet globally, the narrative around Israel is losing ground. And you have spent many, many years as a spokesperson, not just for the government, but also for the Prime Minister. And I'm wondering if, you know, has the world stopped listening? Or has Israel stopped persuading the world?
So obviously I'm a failure. I mean, that's the bottom line. If Israel's reputation is what it is, as I haven't over the years when I was in government, and you obviously know I'm no longer in government. Mm. I'm now retired. Mm. I teach at a university, but all those years in government, I obviously wasn't doing a good job. But besides my own personal responsibility, I would argue, and you don't have to agree with me, that Israel cannot win.
Okay? Really? Why?
I think the deck is stacked against us in such a way that it makes it almost impossible for Israel to win the battle of hearts and minds. And for two fundamental reasons, which we don't control and which we have, I don't think, any ability or very limited ability to overcome. And I can address those two issues. The number one issue is no surprise to you. Hamas is an authoritarian dictatorship in Gaza. And as a result of their dictatorial control, they control all the messages coming out of Gaza. And so when you interview people, they have to live with Hamas and they have to follow the party line. And if you're a photographer working for AP or Reuters, you know what you're allowed to take pictures of and what you're not allowed to take pictures of. And, you know, they work and live in a society where it's not permissible to attack the leadership. And if you do attack the leadership, there are consequences. I mean, you've had in Africa, all too many regimes that were dictatorial and had no tolerance for, you know, freedom of opinion. And in the Middle East, we've got many, and Hamas is an extreme example because in many ways you could even say they're totalitarian because they are authoritarian but with a very clear ideology. And so you put the theological extremism together with authoritarianism and you have totalitarianism. Mm. And so once again, Hamas controls the pictures, the narrative coming out of Gaza. Like, we know that Hamas is very unpopular and the Gaza population wants them to, you know. But you would never know that. Mm.
And I hear that and I understand that. And I'm just, you know, we were talking about political theory a little bit earlier. I'm a communications student. And therefore, war and strategy is something that shows up a lot in communications. And I think about the American general, McNamara, when they came out of Vietnam. And the most telling quote from him was that the America's central failure in Vietnam was not being able to place themselves and see themselves through the eyes of the Vietnamese. And so I'm wondering, on the global sphere, in the global environment, Is there something that you think Israel itself is failing to understand about this asymmetrical war that you are in?
So I think we do understand, but I don't think we have solutions. Because the fact that Hamas controls all the pictures and the narrative coming out of Gaza, that's in itself a problem that is, there's no simple solution until the Hamas regime falls, right? Mm. It's like we're only living off rumors about what's going on in Iran, because once there, again, you don't have a free press and they can control the internet, and people who speak out can end up dead.
Mm.
And so that's one issue. And so all the stories coming out of Gaza, it's almost as if Hamas wrote the talking points.
Mm.
And the second issue, which I think affects South African opinion even more, but globally as well, is the UN. Like, the UN has a very good brand reputation in most of the world. The Secretary General of the UN is, for many people, like some sort of secular pope. Yes, he is the moral authority of the world. And yet the UN, on our issues, is totally biased. Not Mark Regev says so, but two previous Secretary Generals themselves have addressed the institutional obsession that the UN has with Israel, the bias against us. Mm. Both Kofi Annan, former Secretary General, and Ban Ki-moon, former Secretary General, addressed this issue publicly.
Mm.
And the trouble is, the current Secretary General, instead of trying to check this institutional bias, has embraced it.
Mm.
And when people in South Africa and people across the planet are seeing all this stuff coming out of Gaza, which is all according to the Hamas party line, and at the same time it's being reinforced by a UN narrative, how can we win in Israel? How can we win the war of the hearts and minds when the UN, which has, once again, most people on the planet believe that the UN is a force for good, and if the UN is condemning you, how can you win? The most eloquent, the most intelligent, the most convincing Israeli spokesperson can't win when he's up against the UN, because the UN has this cachet of moral force. And that's why I think it's very difficult for Israel to win. You said in your original question to me, you said, so has Israel given up? So I don't think we've given up. We're obviously, I'm here in South Africa trying to, I don't do it for the government anymore, but trying to make my case. I'm not giving up. But I think we've resigned ourselves to the fact that this is a very difficult battle to win.
And what does that then do to the psyche of the people? Right. So Israelis, and there are many dynamics within the country itself, within government. And you've been in rooms that some of us will never dare to dream to be in. But I think there's definitely been a shift in the past 2 years psychologically. What has that done to the people inside the country itself?
I think there can be a bit of a feeling that the world is against you. That also fits into a traditional Jewish narrative, yes, that the world persecuted us, the world ostracized us. Yes, the Jews' persecution and discrimination is not something new to Jews, yes. Anyone who knows Jewish history knows that, you know, Jews have suffered as a minority in many different countries, and now that the Jewish state should be singled out the way it is today, for many Israelis, rightly or wrongly, it fits into that narrative.
Mm.
And it's when we talk about hatred and discrimination, it's not something that's academic for a lot of Israelis. We spoke before, my father was a survivor of the Holocaust, and I'm not unique. Many Israelis have family members who were lost because of anti-Semitic violence.
Mm.
And so in many ways, the criticism we get, you know, internationally, it fits into this traditional Jewish thing that, okay, the world has got a B in its bonnet, a negative B, about Jews and about the Jewish state. That's how I think many Israelis internalize this situation.
Mm. And so what kind of conversations are being had inside the country that the world doesn't get to hear? What are Israelis saying to themselves and to each other?
So I think Israeli society is very transparent. I mean, we've got a lot of foreign journalists in Israel, and Israelis like to debate these issues very forcefully and with drama and with passion. And so our internal arguments, I don't think they're very secret, yes. Mm. But if I could try to conceptualize it, and we were talking before, you know, in political science, there's this theory of soft power and hard power. And I remember when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State of the United States, she talked about soft power. And I talk about when people talk about South Africa's state in the world because of the struggle against apartheid and the changes here, as South Africa has soft power, right? What South Africa says around the world counts more than other countries because it's South Africa. That's soft power. But I think in Israel, there's been a realization, yes, that when you have very real threats to the security of the country and to the safety of our citizens, that soft power is nice to have. And we'd like to have more soft power, but actually old-fashioned hard power, the ability to defend yourself and the ability to defeat those who want to hurt you, that trumps soft power. And if by defeating our enemies and protecting our people, we'll be less popular, it's not so be it, but that's a reality I think that Israelis are willing to accept. Can I just say Golda Meir, who was the Prime Minister of Israel at a time when there were very few females around the planet. She became Prime Minister in 1969. Mm. And unlike Indira Gandhi in India. She was not the daughter of. Mm. Yes, she had to climb her way up what the Israeli famously called the slippery pole, yes? Mm. She famously said, and it deals with this issue of soft power and public relations, she prefers a bad headline to a positive obituary.
Mm.
Now, that's a harsh thing to say, but she was a very smart woman, Golda Meir.
Mm.
It's not by accident she became prime minister. In other words, if we need to do things that safeguard our people and protect them better and defend our borders and our sovereignty, okay, if there's a price in public relations, I don't want to pay that price. Mm-hmm. But if you have to choose between the two, between the positive obituary and the nice headline, you choose the not nice headline.
You know, I mean, you raised two things, and I want to come back and talk about South Africa because you're here. But the peace versus security question, leading up just prior to October 7th, it seemed as if Israel was on the brink of really good relations with its neighbors, right? So the Abrahamic Accords, the people were signing on, and it had normalized. It had seemed to normalize the region. Are you saying then that since then, the posture of the government is one of security, much more than peace, at the moment?
So first of all, you're right when you say that it was, you know, leading up to October 7th, 2023, there was a very optimistic period. The Prime Minister of Israel had just met the President of Turkey at the UN. The Saudi leadership was talking openly about a peace deal with Israel soon, and Saudi Arabia is not just an Arab country, because we've got peace with other Arab countries. We've got peace with Jordan and with Egypt and with the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco, yes, and so forth. But here was the leader of Saudi Arabia saying that he wanted a deal, and Saudi Arabia has a special status not only in the Arab world, but because it is the custodian of the Muslim holy sites, it's also a special status in the larger Islamic world. And that would have been a real breakthrough. And also, shortly before October 7th, the other piece of good news was that the G7 met in India, the G7. And Biden and Modi came out with this proposal of what they called IMEC, the India-Middle East Economic Corridor. And the idea was production is in Asia, consumption is predominantly in Europe, and that to create this corridor that would streamline the traffic and make it much better for everyone, and it would see the countries of the Middle East cooperate to build this better future for Asia, for the Middle East, and for Europe. In other words, it would have also affected Africa, because the same goods that were coming through could come down south to Africa, to those countries who wanted to be part of this process. And so there was all this very good news. And maybe that's one of the reasons that October 7th came as such a slap in the face. It was so difficult, not the the horror of the murdering and the rapes and you know, having your border stormed and your people killed. But the most difficult thing, I think, was it came on the background of, oh, this sort of violence is behind us. And maybe if I, you know, I'm answering now the second part of your question, maybe the illusion that this sort of thing was behind us made us let our guard down. You know, we thought there's a new Middle East of prosperity and cooperation, and we forgot there are people, whether it's Hamas or Hezbollah or the government of Iran. These people are not interested in the new Middle East. These people believe in their holy war against Israel, and they don't want to see Israel in any borders. Yeah, they don't think we have any right to exist. And we maybe because of the good picture that you correctly described, we took our eye off the ball and paid a price.
You know, peace in the Middle East has been a mantra, a chant all my life. And we can literally, you know, pinpoint all of the 7-day war. There are just so many. But there is also a changing world, right? A changing dynamic and a changing world. And where South Africa is today, I think post-apartheid South Africa, there is a relationship with apartheid South Africa that looks like it looked. But post freedom, as it were. Currently, the relations between Jerusalem and Pretoria are very cool, cooler than they've ever been in our new dispensation at the moment. With your ambassadorial hat on, do you believe that, you know, governments can find a way back to each other even after such a cold period as we're seeing now? And what does that take?
Okay, so first of all, I want to stress again that I'm here, sure, not in an official capacity. I'm a retired diplomat. I teach, as I said before, at a university now. But I'll answer now your question. I remember when I was working for the Israeli Prime Minister, we had a visit from Mrs. Merkel. Okay? And she said something very interesting in a speech that she came to Israel, and you understand the complexities of Israeli-German relations. Nothing gets more sensitive. And she said, and I'm not quoting directly from memory, yes? She said, the fact that Germans and Israelis can be good friends and cooperate is a sign that we can overcome historic hardship and hatred and what happened. And so when you said to me, is there a chance that the Israeli-South Africa relationship could get back on track? Of course there's a chance. And Germany is, nothing compares almost to what we had in the Second World War with the Germans who massacred our people, yes? And so if we can have a good relationship, there's no reason we couldn't have a better relationship with South Africa. I think most people in Israel would like to have a better relationship with South Africa.
So then my question is, to you, with all of your experience, your life experience, your experience within government, your experience, and you've worked all over the world, Beijing, Washington, you've worked everywhere. What if you could sit down with a South African and have even one who fundamentally disagrees with the stance of Israel today, politically, and with regard to the war and where it sits, what is the one thing that you would ask them to understand before they judge your country?
So I would ask them to think about the following. South Africa says it believes in peace and that it wants to see the Middle East move on a more positive path. Okay. And bloodshed and so forth. That's the espoused position of the South African government. And I would ask them, how have their policies helped attribute or forward those goals? They've alienated one side. Peace requires two to have good relationships with both sides. And South Africa has decided it only wants to talk to the Palestinians. It talks to the most extreme Palestinians. It talks to Hamas. Not many countries have a relationship with Hamas. South Africa has decided that it wants to have that relationship. But with Israel, no. And so I would ask South Africa, if you want to you want to really be a force for peace and use South Africa's soft power in a positive way in the Middle East, why are you only speaking to one side? And the other issue I'd say to them is we had fighting in Gaza, and we had our hostages in Gaza who were held by Hamas. And in the end, last year, that was sold, the hostages were released, and a sort of ceasefire came into office. Now, it's not perfect, the ceasefire. There's still low-level fighting going on. But it's not the high level, you know, that we had with the sort of death and destruction that we had when the war was intensive. And I don't think while one can be critical and say what we have today is not good, but it's a lot better than
what... It's the absence of.
Yeah, but it's a lot better than what we had when the war was in full acceleration, yes. And I would ask South African government, you know, what did you have to do? How were you involved in getting the hostages released and the fighting lowered dramatically, significantly lowered? And the answer is South Africa was irrelevant because they don't talk to one of the countries. So if their goal was to help the people of Gaza, if their goal was to end the fighting, to lower the level of it, they offered nothing but words.
And on a people-to-people basis, just speaking to an ordinary South African, a young South African, the issue has become quite polarized in South Africa for the people too, because of parallels that are drawn between what is our painful past and what we are seeing beamed at us. To an ordinary South African, what would you ask them to consider before judgment?
So I'm very aware of the painful past that South Africans went through. First of all, colonialism, and then apartheid. It was very, very difficult, I know. But I would ask South Africans to think, are you the only people in the world that have suffered discrimination and racism? My people have also been on the receiving end of very extreme racist hatred and murder. And I think South Africa and Israel are both societies that, you know, you created a new South Africa in the early 90s. We established our own independent state of Israel in the late 1940s. We're both new countries. Surely we can understand both's pain. One of my feelings is that the people of, I'll say that again, the government of South Africa at least, doesn't understand, yes, how important it is for Jewish people that after years, centuries of persecution and discrimination and worse, that we finally have a country where we can call home and protect ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think if the South Africans thought more about that, maybe they'd be more open to understanding us. It doesn't mean you have to agree with everything we do, but at least have a dialogue. South Africa has good relations with many countries that it doesn't agree with everything they do, correct? And so...
Look, I think South Africa, we come from an intractable position for a very long time. South Africa, for a long time, what was happening here between the National Party and all the liberation movements seemed intractable. And in my view, a miracle happened in South Africa, which was that across the table, we were able to reach out to one another and tough conversations were had. I don't think all the way, but as a start. And we are here today, precarious as it may be, with all of its imperfections, but moving together, wobbling forward and trying to figure it out. So I really do believe that South Africa understands intractable situations and how they can be resolved without bloodshed at times, with minimal bloodshed. And so I think my final question is more about strategy and strategic thinking. If you cast your eye forward, right, say 5 years from now, and this is us dreaming in a perfect world, if you were advising as a strategist and not as a spokesperson, Israel on the one side, what should, could they be thinking about differently? as a government to move forward, and South Africa on the other side? What should we be thinking about differently to move forward?
So when you had the optimistic period in South Africa, yes, where you had a new democracy and everyone was very upbeat, it was also a very upbeat period in Israel because we had the Oslo Accords, which had strong support, and they thought Israeli-Palestinian peace was now only a matter of time, a foregone conclusion. But most Israelis are Israelis are much more cynical about the possibility of peace with the Palestinians, unfortunately, anytime soon. And we saw that with the failure of even moderate Palestinians to condemn the 7th of October massacres. For many moderate Israelis who are willing to make a deal, the fact that the people on the other side who they thought understood refused to condemn October 7th unequivocally, that was a problem for people in Israel who wanted peace with the Palestinians. For people on the right who didn't believe it in any way, they said this is just more of the same. But there were many Israelis who believed peace with the Palestinians was possible, and now that community has shrunk. But that doesn't and shouldn't make anyone feel pessimistic about the future, because I think the Middle East is going in a right direction. I think that what I discussed before, peace with Saudi Arabia, the IMEC corridor, better relations with Turkey, I think the situation is stabilizing. This will be over. And when this is over, the same dynamic that brought us into that positive momentum that we are in leading up to October 7th, we'll get back to that. Israel will have more and more relations with Arab countries, more and more relations with Muslim countries. We'll see the expansion of the Abraham Accords. And ultimately, the Palestinians are part of the larger Arab and Muslim world. And if, as Israel is more accepted and seen as more and more legitimate amongst their fellow Arabs and Muslims, I think Palestinian opinion will change too, and they'll be willing to make the compromises for a deal with Israel. All this is based, I think, on a realpolitik assumption. It's not naive. I see the Arab countries and Israel, I see a convergence of interests. I think both the Arab governments and Israel, we don't like the extreme radicals. We don't like Hamas, and we don't like Hezbollah, and we don't like the Iranian government. We want to see stability. We want to see projects like IMEC succeed. We want to see a Middle East built on prosperity and on live and let live. And I think there's a majority there in the Middle East for that. You've got to, if you can't totally defeat, you've got to isolate the extremists who will try to disrupt that, and you've got to work with all the people who want to see a better Middle East. And it's possible, it's doable, and I think it's closer than most people think. I think the minute the fighting will die down, right, you will see an expansion of the Abraham Accords. Saudi Arabia now, because we know from intelligence, yes, that one of the reasons Hamas attacked us on October 7th was because of Saudi Arabia, because they were so worried that the Saudis would make peace with us. But I think it will happen. It's only a matter of time. And because Saudi Arabia has such an important position in the Islamic and in the Arab world, others will follow.
We're not going to get away from talking about Donald Trump.
Okay.
He is the greatest media person alive. But like every day, everywhere around the world, everyone is talking about Trump at least 5 times a day. So this is my last question, and I'm going to keep it short. We've got another 3 years of Donald Trump and his cantankerous nature. Has Donald Trump been a force for good or a force for bad?
So first of all, I'll tell you where the Israelis are.
Yeah.
When Trump stood in an election against Hillary Clinton in 2016, yes, November 16, there was polling done of Israelis. Now, it's only theoretical because Israelis don't get to vote in American elections, yes? But 2/3 were for Hillary and only 1/3 for Trump, okay? For all sorts of reasons, which I can go into, but everyone liked Bill, and so they liked Hillary. And she was also the senator from New York with a large Jewish community, and so she had a strong relationships and so forth. 4 years later, in the election of November 2020, Biden versus Trump, it flipped. Not American Jews, but Israelis were 2/3 Trump to 1/3 Biden. And so we went from being a what they call in America, a red state, yeah? Like a,
from being sorry, a blue sorry, state.
A blue state. A blue state is a Democrat state. Yes. We went from being the bluest of the blue, like California and New York. We went to being the reddest red of the red, like Mississippi and Alabama.
Why?
So you have to ask what happened in Trump's first term that made people move towards him. He recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Now other countries are, you know, by the end of this year, we could have 10 countries with their embassies in Jerusalem. And so that was a big thing for Israelis, because Israelis, for the Israelis, it's always been our capital. It's our historic capital. That it's not recognized abroad, we think is ridiculous. And that made Israelis like him. And then he recognized the Golan Heights as a legitimate part of Israel, which we see the Golan as essential for our security. And then he did the Abraham Accords. He helped us get that peace agreements with four Arab countries, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. The agreement with Sudan fell apart because Sudan fell apart, but there was an agreement there that's on the paper. He's now helping us to get deals with Lebanon, which is very important, and maybe with Syria, we'll see. But for all those reasons and more, Trump won the hearts of the Israelis. Now, everyone's aware of his personality. Everyone is aware of his quirks.
But I think today, if we think about the headlines, he's also a wrecking ball with Iran.
So I think most Israelis would disagree with that.
Mm.
I personally disagree with that, a wrecking ball. The IAEA in 2025 said that Iran was weeks, their language, not mine, weeks away from having enough enriched uranium for a bomb. Today, they're at least 3 years away. Now, if you're Israel, there's a huge difference between being 3 years away from a nuclear weapon than a few weeks, yes? And so even if nothing happens, okay, is the Middle East and the world safer by pushing back the ability of them to be like North Korea and to be a crazy state with a nuclear weapon? I think yes.
Woo! Okay.
You don't have to agree.
I don't. Look, I'm crazy state, all of that. And look, I do think that they, and having done lots of crazy reading, and I'm glad you mentioned Kofi Annan, because I do think that unfortunately South Africa has used its social capital weakly in not being an arbiter, but choosing to assign who's right or wrong. And I think that no other race of people have worked harder. I think Kofi Annan, I think Muhammad Ali getting Americans out of Turkey. I think all of those people have been very instrumental in building a framework that could have created a space for a conversation. And because I'm Zulu, there is, and I'll give you this to take away home with you. We have a saying in Zulu about, and in Zulu you say, izinto zoniwa ngomlomo. So you ruin things with your mouth in what you say, but you can also only fix them with your mouth in how you say the next thing. And I really believe that. I think that there is definitely a far more powerful way of solving conflict by having exhaustive talks about it. And bombs are not the way. Guns are not the way. They may secure you for a little while, but a way to lasting peace, which is why the Abrahamic Accords for me are a path towards that.
I agree with that.
Bombs can secure you for a short while, but unless we reach out to each other and see each other differently, with mutual respect, it is very hard.
So I accept the wisdom. I think it's very right what you say. But I would argue you can only reach out and make a peace, as happened in South Africa, when both sides are ready. It's not enough that one side is ready. Sure. Both sides have to be ready. And is Hamas and Hezbollah and the government of Iran willing to for reconciliation? Unfortunately, I wish it was otherwise. There's no evidence of that. And so I think we have to wait. And in the interim, until something else happens, we have to defend ourselves. I just don't see an alternative.
And so sadly, My whole life, later, here I am, a grown up, and still feel that it's necessary to chant peace in the Middle East. And I wish you peace.
I thank you. I hope we, and I believe it's possible, we will achieve it in the not too distant future.
From your lips to God's ears.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.